The insiders are saying, give me it now. I want off. I want off the paper exchange. I want the real thing. That's going to funnel its way down to the retail market. Now, of course, any type of an event, whether it be a second wave, whether it be the chaos that comes along with the election, or any event, is going to exacerbate the retail demand. But in general, I would say the retail public is always one or two steps behind the big money.
One needs to realize that gold stocks are stocks, and if the stocks go down, the gold stocks will in the near term be affected. The likely policy response to that, of course, quantitative easing, artificially low interest rates, all that kind of stuff, are ultimately good for gold and the gold equities. The fact is that there's no certainty in life, Donegan, as far as I'm concerned. There's a range of probabilities. And I think the prudent speculator pays attention to the probabilities and positions him or herself according to the probabilities as they see them, with a margin for error. So, yes, maintain U.S. dollar liquidity. Yes, maintain bullion as liquidity, too. If you can afford to invest after you've saved, certainly buy some of the gold equities.
The economy will gradually reopen, but we're not going to reopen back to where we were last February. We're going to reopen into a new world that's very different from what we left in February. And the changes are going to be intergenerational. We're talking stuff that's going to last for 30 years.
You're seeing more announcements of companies going straight into liquidation. And that is very economically damaging. And everybody gets wiped out. And it's going to take a generation, perhaps, to try and put these Americans who are going to be out of work back to work, which means it will be a drag on taxpayers. And that is what concerns me the most, because I think that we're going to have increased social spending for a very, very long time. And that puts us on a slippery slope to socialism.
We've had a large amount of new debt created just in the last few months because the Fed's been there to buy it. And because rates are now back at zero, which makes it very cheap to continue to borrow. That creates this bigger snowball effect going forward. And that creates a situation where we are more ripe for a larger financial crisis than we've seen so far. So bigger than the financial crisis in 2008, bigger than what the coronavirus pandemic has unleashed. I think right now, silver actually is expanding in terms of its appeal. And it goes through cycles, so it's not like the first time, but particularly right now, where the better way to invest in it is not to sort of worry about the squeeze per se or what's going on the financial basis, but to literally buy silver. Like literally people want to invest, buy physical silver coins.
When you put your money in the bank is the safe custodian of your money, whereas legally, you are a unsecured creditor to the bank. So what most don't understand is that when you deposit money in a bank, you legally have given the bank a loan.
The gold-silver ratio, even if it was 80 today, if it really was globally, or 70 that we were talking, it would still be higher than the norm for the gold-silver ratio, which often oscillates around 40 or 45 to 1. And then in terms of the 1980 bull run, actually went down briefly to 15 to 1. We're in rarefied areas here that normally do not prevail. And I don't think a person should get hung up on, oh, it's only 78 to 1 now. I've missed the opportunity and I shouldn't exchange. They should say, you know, the higher it is, the more gold they should feel comfortable exchanging for silver, if that's what they're looking for, to play that ratio. But the idea of having it in hand and having the coverage, you should still want to be acquiring it, even if the ratio is considerably lower than what you think gives you your best shot at the big returns.
The destruction of the currency adds another dimension to what we saw in the 1930s, and that is the trashing of personal wealth. Anyone who has financial assets, anyone who has cash, deposits in the banks and all the rest of it, is going to lose, and lose possibly everything.
The dollar is going to suffer the fate of all fiat currencies. It's backed by nothing. And now the government is on tilt. This is a term that poker players use. I play poker when I can. And sometimes when a player is on a losing streak, he just goes wild, doubling down, desperately hoping for luck to bail him out. And that's exactly what the U.S. government's done. So the cat's out of the bag. They'll print unlimited numbers of dollars in a hope to keep the old rotten structure from collapsing, but it will collapse. And in the process, they're going to destroy the dollar.
And I already feel, I don't know if you do, you feel people themselves are changing. I know personally, I don't hardly spend any money because I don't go anywhere. And I'm sure other people feel the same way. And so it's like all of a sudden, you don't really need anything. You know, all you want is your freedom. And that's what scares me, is that, is our freedom going to be taken away from us? It really frightens me. And on a certain level, you say, no, we've had freedom our whole life. How can this change? But it's something to consider and think about when you see how is all this central bank madness going to work out. To us, the best safety we could have is physical gold. And because there, you, whatever happens, you will have a way of having money in your hand.
Yes, there's going to be some sort of action against gold. There's going to have to be. I mean, how high does the total debt pile get? It's 275 trillion now or something. What are you going to go to a quadrillion or something? I mean, okay, how high does it get before you look at measly gold with 11 trillion total valuation in the world with no counterparty risk? It's going to go much higher. And then once it does, it's like it's going to be a problem because it's a truth serum for the overall system. We know this is what's going to happen. So while you're still waiting for that to happen, play that. There's your trade. And when that's over, there'll be something else to do. We don't know what it is now, but we don't need to know what it is now.
How much of a plandemic, scamdemic, hoax, or reality it is, doesn't matter from the aspect of what they are gaining, they, the powers that be, as far as being able to do a lockdown grid all basically over the planet. And they're not going to let that crisis go to waste, especially when they've got round two coming.
For the first time in 30 years, we are seeing massive mainstream participation. Massive. I never got mainstream participation before, ever. And now it's very common to have someone say, I've never bought gold before. I just cashed out of the stock market. Because remember, those people used to go to the bond market. They're not going there anymore. People who are looking to protect their money and their purchasing power and their wealth and their family's safety, they're coming here. And that's creating way more demand at a period of time when supply is tenuous. So isn't that kind of what the definition of inflation is? Far more money chasing fewer and fewer supply. And that's what's happening, that the mints or the distributors are feeding the massive demand, and that's pushing the price up as more and more people are realizing that safety is found in precious metals. And I think it will continue. This is why I'm saying people should be buying right now.
The big money is showing what they're doing. They're requesting delivery. They're taking it off the exchange. And I think you'll see that funnel on down this fall to the retail side, where, once again, I'm preparing for massive premiums and shortages.
Last time gold really moved, which was the year 2000, it moves from a low of, what, to $250 to $1,900 over 10 years. So what I was trying to say was not specifically 18 months, but merely that the move was getting started and had some legs. As to the time, I wouldn't pay too much attention to the date. I would pay attention to the level of real interest rates. If you saw the interest rate on the U.S. 10-year Treasury at 7% and you saw the underlying rate of inflation at 4%, in other words, if you were getting 300 basis points in real yield, then exit the gold. I don't think you're going to see that.
In the past, they say, when you get a financial crisis, everybody rushes for dollars. Not quite true. What they rush for is dollar liquidity. And there's a big difference between having dollar liquidity and owning loads and loads of illiquid dollars. Now, the illiquid dollars are in stocks, they're in US treasuries, and so on. They can easily be liquidated. But think what happens to the securities markets, financial asset values, if you get that sort of selling, and the selling being followed through by the dollar itself being sold. Then you can see quite quickly how the pressures are going to be for rising interest rates rather than falling rates. The record level of longs held by the non-reportables was about 158,000 contracts. That was recorded on the 24th of March, literally a day or two after the bottom. So this is smart money. The smart money is in the non-reportable category. And they bought the market right at the bottom of that smash. They are close to record long again, which if what I say is valid, that this is smart money, tells us that the squeeze is about to enter a new phase.
The feeling that we're on the cusp of something really historic here, which the last couple of weeks kind of gave us a little bit of a sample of what that just might look like.
There are some fascinating things happening right now on the COMEX market that are changing the entire landscape. A couple of days ago was the largest amount of contracts that have ever stood for delivery on the COMEX market. You're getting the family offices and the high net worth individuals and the big funds. They're pulling money off the exchange. This cripples the commercial bank's ability to naked short, because if you're naked shorting something and no one's buying it, no one wants it, well, yeah, it's easy to do. But if you're naked shorting something and everyone's clamoring for it at a period of time when the demand is far outstripping the available supply, you're going to have a spiritual experience if all of a sudden things start to move against you. And I would argue that's exactly what we saw happening last week as the commercial banks were covering. But I think indeed that we are entering a period of time where you're going to see massive increase in interest from the elite. And the pulling off of the metal off the exchange to me is very emblematic of where things are going and what the sophisticated investor's viewpoint is of physical possession of gold right now.
From 1929 to 1939 was something known as the Great Depression. Many of you have grandparents or great-grandparents that lived through that time period. My grandparents were definitely affected, and it affected the rest of their lives. I remember seeing tinfoil folded up, the canning that went on with my grandmother, just the frugal living, even though when they died, they had well over $1 million in the bank. One of the things that happened during the Great Depression was that a lot of people had invested a lot of money in America. And when that money was recalled because of the crash, a lot of businesses failed and a lot of people were laid off work and a lot of people lost their homes. My grandmother in particular, it was really funny. One time she was talking about the Great Depression and she said, you know, it was funny because we didn't really realize we were in a Great Depression because we were poor already. And this, of course, was during that time period. Also, one thing that she did say was that if we ever have another Great Depression, she goes, I'm worried, because back then people helped each other. They worked together. Said, now people being so selfish and so mean, she goes, it really worries me what could happen. Now, one of the big problems was housing. People lost their homes. A lot of the banks closed, and because of that, they weren't able to get their savings out. They weren't able to, you know, get money that they had put back. If they didn't have it in their home or on their person, they just didn't have the money, especially when those who lost their jobs. And because of industry just closing down everywhere, there just weren't jobs available. And so these people lost their homes, or a lot of families would move in together. They'd have moms and dads move in with their adult children, grandparents, aunts and uncles. I mean, the house would be full. But together they could survive by working together, doing their part in helping to pay the house payment. A lot of people slept in their cars and their trucks. A lot of people just went out and lived in tents and lean-tos. Power was difficult. A lot of places didn't even have power then. But paying the power bill was just an added expense. And it's one of the things that's a big saying is we had everything except money. And money makes the world go round. Now, one thing, especially during heat waves, when there was no power, people would take sheets, wet them, and put them up in the doorways. And as the wind blew through, it would cool off the room. Another thing is they would sleep outside at night in their lawns or in parks to stay cool. A lot of times when we say SHTF, we think of roving bands of bandits and, you know, riots and civil unrest, which is definitely possible. But there always comes a point where life kind of settles back and things, you know, like food, shelter, and clothing, you know, are the essentials. Now, one of the problems was jobs. There just weren't any jobs. Factories had closed. There were a lot of people looking for work. Some people would just load up in their vehicles and drive wherever they had to find work. A lot of people would follow the harvest and would become really migrant workers. They would take their families around and go from location to location just harvesting produce and vegetables or tending, you know, livestock or whatever they could do to just be able to get that food and just pay the necessities just to live. You know, it was a really bad time of hardship. It was really funny because a lot of farms in some areas just couldn't pay the workers because the food was going for so cheap. And because of that, large areas of crops just rotted while people in other areas starved to death. You know, that is one thing that if transportation were to come to a standstill, you know, a lot of the country would be in big trouble, especially the urban areas. Being able to produce food is very difficult. Now, it was funny, a lot of people would go around and just do odd jobs, whatever they could do. You know, whether it was fix a fence, work on a door, fix plumbing, you know, whatever it took. But the one thing is, the more skill that you had, the better your chance was to earn money. We all have different skills, but are those skills based on only technology? You know, learning those type skills to be able to have something to barter with. You know, I'll repair your fence if you give me a dozen eggs. And when you're really hungry, that's a great deal. Now, children were also expected to find ways to earn money. In fact, no one was immune, except maybe the youngest, to go out and find odd jobs, maybe to collect things, maybe to find wild berries and fruits and things that were out in nature, gather up firewood to be able to sell it. There were a lot of things to do. A lot of people just went around and looked for things that were free. But one thing too is we're actually going more to a cashless society. Many of you don't even carry cash in your billfold because that credit card or that debit card is so convenient. But guys, I'll tell you, and I've said this in a number of videos, having some cash put back is just like, it's better than money in the bank. There it is, you have it, and if things go south, you're able to at least have something to rely on. And it'll at least give you some time. You know, it kind of cuts down on the panic. I know during the Depression, my other grandmother, she used to cut hair just for a living. And people would come by and she would cut their hair, she would charge a little bit, and it would just give the family that much more money to be able to use for things that they needed. A lot of ladies went and started cooking meals for workers. And so the workers would come by and pick up the meals and pay her, and then they would be able to, again, help their family and to be able to get by. Now, because the Depression lasted 10 years, clothing began to be worn and tattered. Being able to put patches on clothes, being able to actually sew, to be a seamstress, to be able to make clothes. You know, that is something that we have really lost, the skill that we've lost. And so being able to do those where you can repair the clothes, repair a lot of different things, but clothes in particular. One thing that was kind of funny is they would take the rubber from tires and use them to resole shoes. And having the equipment, the thick needles, or whatever you need to get through that tire rubber to be able to attach it to a leather shoe, you know, is something that, you know, would be tough. And I think one of the things that is definitely something to take away here is having the right tools, being able to have the tools to repair and to fix things. Last but not least, food. And that pretty much goes unsaid, how important food is. But, you know, our gardening skills have weakened. You know, we don't garden like we used to. And it's very important to have gardening skills, even if it's just a small garden in your backyard that possibly you could expand. Another thing is with hybrid seeds, you know, you're not able to reproduce seeds and reproduce those vegetables. So, you know, having some kind of heirloom seed that you can harvest. A lot of times in the Depression, they grew huge gardens, and it takes a lot of food to be able to feed your family. And with that, they would take food that they had excess or surplus of, and they would trade it with maybe a farmer that had chickens or a farmer that had beef, and they would trade around, and it would help to kind of supplement their diet. A lot of people, though, really went hungry, and they just used whatever items they had. You know, Depression soup was just whatever they could find and whatever they could put together. And sometimes the taste wasn't excellent, but sometimes the taste was really good. Guys, you know, a lot of people just go out to eat on most of their meals, and they don't really keep a lot of food in their pantry, and even if they did, they wouldn't really know how to prepare that much. One of the big things with the Depression was that a lot of the prepared foods, whether it was restaurants or even grocery stores, had very little as far as in prepared foods. They had the basics. And so learning how to use those foods, how to cook from scratch, is a big deal. It's something that really would be great to practice especially now that we have a lot of resources, we can do that and we can learn. Plus, it's just a lot of fun. Now, you may have a lot of long-term food storage, which we do, but being able to process that food is something that takes some skill. And really, you need to know how to take those foods, how to take those dried beans and that rice and be able to put it together to make it something palatable. Of course, one big thing was community gardens. A lot of times in parks and things like that, the city just opened it up and people would have their plot and they would grow vegetables. But also hunting and fishing. Guys, if you've never skinned a rabbit or a deer or whatever, you know, that you're going out, or if you don't really know about wild edibles, going out and finding those wild edibles, now is a very important time to learn those things. So guys, there's a lot of resources out there. There are a lot of good books on the Depression, and I highly recommend you start reading some of those. Maybe just do some research into the Depression, see what really went on. It could possibly give you a lot of good ideas. You know, a lot of times we have certain plans and ideas about bugging out or bunkering in and all this stuff, but we don't really get down to the nitty-gritty of everyday life. And guys, one thing I want to leave you with is one of the things that really impressed me about looking over all this with the Great Depression is that people helped each other. They reached out, they worked together, they did what they could. If they had a little extra, they were willing to give it to someone else and, you know, to help one another. A lot of times in the prepper community and the survival community, we get very lone wolf minded. And guys, it takes a group to come together. You can't do it on your own. You've got to build a team. And guys, the more that you have together of good, solid people, the better off you're going to be. And guys, if you're really serious about prepping and survival, check out Survival Dispatch Insider. It is the best source on the web to learn about real world prepping and survival. A lot of the world's leading experts are there on the Insider. I upload one video a week that's exclusive to the Insider, and guys, I'll tell you, it will transform the way you think about survival and prepping. And I'll have a link down below in the description. Be strong, be of good courage. God bless America. Long live the Republic.
This is Mr. Montgomery. I met him a few weeks ago in New York.
Oh, how are you? You live here?
Yes.
Well, maybe you know what a zombie is.
When a person dies and is buried, it seems there are certain voodoo priests who have the power to bring him back to life.
How horrible.
It's worse than horrible because a zombie has no will of his own. You see them sometimes walking around blindly with dead eyes, following orders, not knowing what they do, not caring.
You mean like Democrats?
The following has been rated PC for politically correct.
Pay attention, you just may learn something.
It's the Sage, Larry Elder.
I was talking about how complicated it would be for those who are proposing reparations to come out with some sort of formula. We hadn't even talked about the role of African chieftains in the slave trade. Now, he said if blacks owned thousands of black slaves, and they did, so too did American Indians, or people we now call Native Americans. By the middle of the 1700s, various tribes, especially the so-called five civilized tribes of the Southeast, began to acquire black slaves. And by the end of the century, the Cherokee owned nearly 1,000, the Greek, the Seminole, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw owned thousands more. Numbers grew sharply, he said, during the early 19th century when the tribes were removed to the Indian Territory. Mostly during the 1830s, they took thousands of black slaves with them. Accompanying the Cherokee on their Trail of Tears were some 2,000 black slaves, and they were put to work on farms in the new tribal home, raising cotton, corn, crops, tending hogs and cattle. At the time, a Methodist minister named Henry C. Benson said, quote, "As far as they are able, even the very poor Indians will manage to get possession of one or two Negroes to perform their heavy work. Indians are known to cherish an invincible disgust for manual labor," close quote. and thus used slaves. He writes that the five civilized tribes cooperated fully with the enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act. Now, whether this meant returning slaves to white owners or to Indian slave masters, they returned them. In 1842, in an organized action, some 20 black slaves stole firearms and ran away from their Cherokee owners. They stole horses and mules along the way, headed south into the Creek Nation, and they were joined by 15 runaway slaves. The combined group came upon a white man, James Edwards, and his Delaware Indian sidekick, Billy Wilson, who were returning some runaway slaves to the Choctaw. And they killed them both. Meanwhile, a force of Cherokee and Creek, in an unusual instance of cooperation, were hot on the runaways' trail. They captured them near Red River. Five of the slaves were later found guilty of the murders of Edwards and the Indian sidekick and were put to death. The rest were returned to their owners. What punishment they suffered, he writes, is unknown. Now, the 13th Amendment, ratified in the fall of 1865, abolished slavery in the U.S. as a whole, but not among the five civilized tribes. Now, although the Indians were under protection of the United States, it was unclear how the Constitution would apply to them. As a consequence, blacks remained as slaves in the Indian Territory until July and August 1866, after the U.S. government negotiated new treaties with the individual tribes that included specific clauses prohibiting slavery. Even then, some slaveholders among the so-called five civilized tribes did not comply until 1867. End of quote. This entire piece, very lengthy, is up on LarryElder.com. It's written by historian Roger McGrath. It's called Getting Real About Reparations. Now, you've talked a lot about how universal slavery was, and the fact is that there were white slaves. There were Irish who were indentured servants, many of them treated, in fact, worse than slaves. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that's another little-known fact of slavery. Slavery was not reserved for blacks because of their race. Slavery is old as man himself. And slavery in the Americas in the 1630s, tens of thousands of slaves from Ireland began to be shipped to Barbados and other islands there of the Eastern Caribbean. Something like 100,000 altogether. Technically, it could be said they were indentured servants. However, the majority didn't sign any contract of indenture. They were simply rounded up by Cromwell's soldiers in Ireland after the Cromwellian Wars in Ireland, which left so many families without a male head to the family because the Irishman had died or was sent into exile, and his wife and children were vulnerable. They were collected, put in pens, and branded with the name of the ship, letters representing the name of the ship, the slave ship, that would take them to the Americas, islands in the Caribbean. And this went down to children, 7-8-year-old children. They were sold at auction in Barbados, in Martinique, in Montserrat, in St. Lucia, all of these islands. And there, very few of them lasted much more than 6 or 7 years because of the sun, skin cancer, all sorts of diseases, malnourishment, incredibly hard labor. Because the owners of them didn't expect to keep them for 40 years. They expected, well, they're going to be freed after 7 years. Some were extended, of course, because of minor infractions. Another 2 or 3 years was added to their indenture. The few lucky ones who survived, many of them came to the American colonies, but that was only a tiny minority. Most of them died there in the Caribbean.
I'm talking to historian Dr. Roger McGrath. He taught at UCLA for 15 years. He's got a couple of pieces we have up on LarryElder.com, Getting Real About Reparations. The other one is called White Slaves. Roger, you've also talked about the fact that there were blacks who owned slaves and also Native Americans who owned slaves.
Well, upwards of 4,000 free blacks in the American South owned slaves. Something over 20,000 black slaves were owned by, owned by black slave masters. And this is right on the eve of the Civil War. And in fact, they continued owning them right through the Civil War and down to the enactment of the 13th Amendment.
Dr. McGrath, let's hold it right here because I want to find out what percentage of slave owners around 1860 were black. I'm sure it's a small number, but I want to get some idea of the perspective of that. My guest is Dr. Roger McGrath. He's a historian, taught for 15 years at UCLA, also taught at Cal State University Northridge and at Pepperdine University, and in 1999 awarded the prestigious California Military History Medal. Roger, we were talking about the number of blacks who owned slaves. As a percentage of slave owners in the country, what are we talking about?
Well, it's a very small percent. There's about 250,000 free blacks in the Old South in 1860, and about 4,000 of them owned slaves. So it's about 2 to 3% of the free blacks in the Old South owned slaves, and compared to the white slave holding population, it was very small. But yet, the white slave holding population among whites was very small. Also, only about 5 or 6% of whites in the Old South owned slaves. Now, if you extend it to their families, but same thing for the blacks, if you extend it to their families, it meant about 20% in some way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Whites in the Old South were involved or part of slave-holding families. And the same thing would be true with the free blacks. It would mean something like 10% of free blacks were somehow involved as slave-holding families. However, you get certain areas where the percentage is rather high. In New Orleans, about 28% of the free blacks owned slaves themselves. So this varied throughout the South. But in all 13 of the states that became Confederate states, there were significant numbers of black slaveholders. And this was true of the cities as well.
Mm-hmm.
In some areas, the greatest number of slaves in Charleston City, for example, the port for Charleston, the largest slaveholder was a black woman.
Wow.
How did we get here? I mean, literally. Not just you and me, but the whole shebang. How is any kind of life possible? The universe is a hostile place. Solar flares, cosmic rays, asteroids flying about. The odds against our existence are truly astronomical. Take it from me. I'm an astrophysicist. My job is to look out into space at stars and galaxies, trying to answer these basic, how did the universe come to be questions. Well, those who have a religious faith have an answer. God. The Earth's distance from the sun, the size of the atom, and a thousand other things large and small that allow us to live and to breathe and to think all seem perfectly tuned for our existence. To many, this design suggests a designer. But from a purely scientific point of view, the faithful have a big problem. They can offer no indisputable proof for this belief. Because of the lack of hard evidence, it's probably not surprising that over 70% of the members of the National Academy of Sciences declare themselves to be atheists. But they have a big problem, too. Absent a creator, how do they account for the existence of the universe, of planet Earth, of human consciousness? How do they account for the existence of anything? Well, it turns out they have an answer, and it's become all the rage in scientific circles. It's called the multiverse, and according to many scientists, our universe isn't the whole ballgame. Far from it. These scientists argue that there's an awful lot of universes out there, not just one or two, but an infinite number of them. Let me explain. 13.8 billion years ago, there was a big bang. From something unimaginably small, we don't know exactly what, the universe exploded into existence. How did it happen? Why did it happen? It doesn't matter, because it happened. immediately after the Big Bang, the universe underwent a rapid expansion. Think of a gush of bubbles exploding from a seriously shaken soda can just after it's popped open. Cosmologists call this the theory of inflation. As the universe inflates and expands, the bubble universes grow and separate to become their own distinct entities, each with their own unique properties. In other words, new universes are spawned, and not just a handful, an infinite number of them. Some of these universes would be too cold for life and some too hot. But with an infinite number, surely one is bound to get it just right. In short, you and I are just an accident that, given enough universes, was inevitable. But wait, there's more. Because there are so many universes, it's very likely, according to the multiverse scenario, that everything that could possibly happen does happen in one universe or another. That girlfriend who broke up with you, you're married to her in another universe. Does this sound a bit far-fetched, a little too science fiction-y? Well, not to Nobel Prize-winning scientists like Steven Weinberg or the famed cosmologist Stephen Hawking, as well as a myriad of others who wholeheartedly endorse him. But here's what's really surprising. They endorse it knowing there's not a single shred of hard scientific evidence that supports it. And how can there be? There's no way we can access another universe. In short, a vast number of the world's most eminent scientists believe in something that hasn't been, and in all likelihood will never be proven. How does that sound to you? Probably the same way it sounds to the distinguished physicist Paul Davies, invoking an infinity of unseen universes to explain the unusual features of the one we do see is just as made up as invoking an unseen creator. The multiverse theory may be dressed up in scientific language, but in essence, it requires the same leap of faith. Or, as G.K. Chesterton quipped, when men stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. For multiverse believers, this is literally true. The same scientists who reject God's existence due to the lack of evidence pin their hopes on a theory so all-inclusive and vague, it could never be refuted. Those who believe God created the universe are intellectually honest enough to admit that they do so on the basis of faith. But those who believe in the multiverse are also keeping the faith. They just don't admit it. So let me ask you, who's taking the bigger leap? I'm Brian Keating, professor of physics at the University of California, San Diego for Prager University. Thank you for watching this video. To help keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.
The world's most famous atheist has just become a believer in God. A book titled There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Has Changed His Mind. Anthony Flew, the famous British atheist, has come to believe in God, and he's written a book. Listen to what he says. I must stress that my discovery of the divine has proceeded on a purely natural level. It has been an exercise in what is traditionally called natural theology. Nor do I claim to have any personal experience of God or any experience that may be called supernatural or miraculous. In short, my discovery of the divine has been a pilgrimage of reason and not of faith. Does reason lead people to believe in God? Yes, it does. There is a God, says Anthony Flew, former notorious atheist, and he's written a book by that title. He says atheists claim that the laws of nature exist reasonlessly and that the universe is ultimately absurd. As a scientist, I find this is hard to accept. There must be an unchanging rational ground in which the logical, orderly nature of the universe is rooted. So says former atheist Anthony Flew. He said, so multiverse or not, we still have to come to terms with the origin of the laws of nature. And the only viable explanation here is the divine mind. That's a pretty strong statement for a former atheist. In fact, the most notorious one in the Western world. Anthony Flew says, the only satisfactory explanation for the origin of such end-directed, self-replicating life as we see it on Earth is an infinitely intelligent mind. powerful statement from Anthony Flew. He said, some features of the cosmological argument may indeed be the correct ones. It's a very promising explanation, probably the finally right one. Anthony Flew's book, There Is a God, The World's Most Notorious Atheist, is a book that you need to get and to read. He has an appendix in here by the famous Anglican Bishop N.T. Wright, in which he says, as I have said more than once, no other religion enjoys anything like the combination of a charismatic figure like Jesus and a first-class intellect like St. Paul. If you're wanting omnipotence to set up a religion, it seems to me that this is the one to beat. Anthony Flew is very close to becoming a believer. He includes in his book an appendix by N.T. Wright in which he says, God became man in Jesus Christ, lived here on earth. There's good historical evidence for it. And Anthony Flew, who now claims to be a deist, who believes that there is a God who created the world, is just two steps away from becoming a believer. The next step is, if God exists, said the former atheist C.S. Lewis, miracles are possible. And if miracles are possible and the New Testament documents are historically reliable, as N.T. Wright gave a good summary in Appendix B of Anthony Flew's new book, then it's reasonable to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. This is mere Christianity, as C.S. Lewis put it. This is an exciting thing. When the most notorious atheist in the Western world, Anthony Flew, has now come to the conclusion that there must be a God. He says it's simply inconceivable that any material matrix or field can generate agents who can think and act. This is a powerful testimony for the existence of the God of the Bible.